Welcome to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we aim to take you to the heart of ag policy. I'm Spencer Chase. Our guest this week is Nebraska Senator Deb Fischer, who joins us to discuss her legislation to reform cattle price discovery practices. But first, here's this week's headlines. The Supreme Court will hear arguments in a case seeking to overturn California's Proposition 12. The ballot measure created animal housing standards for all pork sold in the state, no matter where it was produced. The High Court announced Monday it will entertain arguments in a case brought by the American Farm Bureau Federation and the National Pork Producers Council. Those two groups have the backing of 20 states and a handful of other organizations in their argument that Prop 12 violates the Dormant Commerce Clause. The state of California has the backing of the Humane Society of the United States as well as other animal welfare groups. President Joe Biden rolled out his fiscal 2023 budget earlier this week. The package includes $31 billion in funding for discretionary spending at the Department of Agriculture, including $4 billion for ag research and $1.8 billion for climate-related programs. As with other budgets by presidents before him, Biden's budget has little chance of actually becoming the nation's spending plan, but it does start the appropriations process on Capitol Hill. Lawmakers have until the end of September to find a way to fund the government for all or part of the next fiscal year. And finally, a bipartisan group of senators has rolled out updates to a bill aimed at addressing price discovery for beef cattle producers. The new version of the Cattle Price Discovery and Transparency Act has several changes, but keeps the bill's hallmark policy, a cash trade mandate for different regions throughout the country. The new legislation does, however, change the way regions are defined by opening a USDA rulemaking process on the issue. There's also a tweak to the formula used to determine trade in each region and the removal of some confidentiality language from the previous version. But the cash trade mandate is what drove some farm groups to oppose the original bill, and keeping it in the new legislation has already elicited some frustration. Nebraska Republican Deb Fischer has been a leading member on the legislation and the issue. When we spoke with her, we asked her why it was important to retain the mandates in the new bill.
You know, from the very beginning, my priority was to make sure that we could ensure price discovery and market transparency in the cattle market. And that has been what I've heard from stakeholders and family farmers and ranchers. We did make three main changes to address some of the concerns with the first draft that we had out. And I think we've answered them very well. First of all, the LMR reporting regions, they remain the same, but the bill does expand coverage area to the whole United States, continental United States. But the second tweak we made really focuses on which packers are covered, because we had a lot of farmers and ranchers who their deepest concern is that 85% of cattle slaughter is handled by four big packers. So we were trying to make sure that those big packers that account for that 85% that they would be the ones who are covered. So for example, even though it says all states are covered, you have to have one of those big packers in your state in order to become a part of this. Idaho will not. Agribeef, they do not slaughter enough cattle to trigger that mandatory negotiated price.
Mm-hmm. So I want to circle back to the regional point that you raised there, because while it does maintain the LMR regions, it's also going to create some new borders for folks to keep an eye on through a USDA rulemaking, you know, if and when the bill should be passed. Any concerns on your end about confusion that might be bred by having, you know, multiple different borders to keep track of here?
I don't think so at all, because USDA, they can move borders right now. That's in current law. They can move borders right now. So I think when some people are concerned about that, or somebody is trying to put up a false flag, that's exactly what it is. It's a false flag. That can happen now. Our bill makes really plain that that we are looking at those four big packers, 85% of the cattle that's slaughtered. And then we also, another part of the bill that we change it expands the way that packers can meet those mandatory minimums. It's through negotiated cash sales, it's through the negotiated grid, it's at stockyards, sale barns, and it's also through the trading systems, through the Federal Cattle Exchange, through online trading. So there are four ways out there, and all of those contribute to price discovery.
We'll be right back with more from Senator Fisher right after this.
Regenerative poultry production is a process by which nature can actually recapture and restore the energy that is being taken out of our space.
Farm Credit helped Rahe build his dream of regenerative poultry farming and encouraging fellow immigrants to find community in agriculture.
Nothing beats a farm. I'm just pursuing happiness.
Learn more at farmcredit.com/beginning.
Welcome back. The previous legislation from Senators Fisher, Grassley, and others had some economists worried that producers might actually end up paying for the bill due to lost efficiencies. But Senator Fisher says she's confident the new bill is the right way to go.
When you look at the studies that have been quoted, most recently the Texas A&M study, part of that study says that that Texas, in that southern region, that by 2026, they will have zero negotiated cash sales. We're moving in the wrong direction here. Obviously, we want to protect the contracts that producers have, that cattle feeders have with packers. We want to be able to see those still happen, and they will. They will, but let's be honest about the premiums that the packers pay. And I can tell you that that it doesn't always happen with an AMA. But you put in a negotiated grid as part of this, that's going to recognize premiums that these feeders can receive for their cattle. Because there's going to be, obviously, a grid that's out there. When they have a better grading on their cattle, they're going to get more for their price. They'll be able to negotiate that way. I think this is all extremely important for these, you know, family farmers and ranchers who are part of this big system. You know, I always say in Nebraska, we are so fortunate that we have every segment. We have cow-calf producers, we have background feeders, we have large and small feedlots, and we have three of the four big packers. This has a huge economic impact on my state. I want this to succeed, and I believe by working with stakeholders, whether it was my Nebraska Cattlemen or Farm Bureau, a U.S. Cattlemen, Farmers Union, to be able to work with all these stakeholders and then work with USDA to make sure that our language is right. We've spent a lot of time making sure that the technical details of this bill are right. And then, in fact, Senator Grassley, Senator Tester and I, we're going to be meeting with Senator Vilsack this morning, too, because we have a great consensus. We have the majority of the Ag Committee here in the Senate supportive. There is a movement. There is momentum. And it's because senators are hearing from the people they represent in their states. I know I hear from people who this is their livelihood. And they get it, and they want us here in Congress to get it done so that they can be profitable, they can be part of this system, and be able to continue to provide for their families.
Well, and on that point, Senator, I mean, I know I'm not telling you anything when I say it's one thing to write a bill, it's another thing to pass a bill. The path forward on potential passage of that bill, what can you tell us about the timeline that you're looking at and the vehicles that you think might be available?
You know, we've spent a lot of time making sure that this bill is in great shape. We continue to talk to other senators now that we have the bill that we want. And as I said, we have the majority of the senators on the Senate Ag Committee. We've worked with Senator Stabenow's office. She is ready to go with the hearing. Senator Bozeman and I visited. He promised that you know, he's not going to stand in the way. We're going to be having a hearing. We're going to be taking a vote on this bill in committee. And then as it moves to the floor, we feel very, very good about the chances of getting this done this year.
Any conversations at this point with your friends in the House?
We have informal conversations. Obviously, you know, they're following this bill as well. And there's a lot of support there too, because they hear from the same constituents that we do. But we're taking this one step at a time. We're making sure we do it right. We're making sure that that our stakeholders, that the people in our state are very, very supportive, and to be able to answer any questions that still may be out there. You know, I'm a member of Farm Bureau. I'm a member of Nebraska Cattlemen and the NCBA. We've tried voluntary approach in the past. NCBA did that. And at the time they said, if this fails, we're going to look at a more robust way to address this. And so this is a solution, and we believe it's the correct solution. And we're not hearing a lot of solutions from those who just say they oppose it for this reason. We haven't heard an alternative put forward. And you know, you can talk to Senator Grassley, who he's been working on this issue for 20 years. And then you know, I put out a different approach to it a few years ago. And he understands that if we're going to get this done, we need to do it now. So I'm just really fortunate that he worked with me and signed on to my bill. And like I said, we have great bipartisan support. So yeah, we're moving. We'll have a hearing after our work period, this next work period.
Senator, I want to close off on a bit of a different subject and take a bit of a turn on you, but we've talked a lot about the price discovery issue, but also a lot of calls being directed at the administration right now to allow summertime sales of E15. I know this is an issue that's near and dear to your heart. You've introduced some legislation previously to that effect. Does Congress have a role here to expand those summertime E15 sales through legislation, or is this an administrative action that needs to happen?
It should happen through Congress. Obviously, you know, I'm in the legislative branch, and we need to pass laws. Sometimes we see the executive take action on things through executive orders. That is not a preferable way to do things, because then when you have a change in administrations, you have those rescinded. For example, E15 year-round. For example, WOTUS. The Trump administration had, I believe, a better view on what waters of the United States should be than the current administration. So it would be better to do it through Congress, but that doesn't mean that I'm not out there pressuring this administration so that we can have year-round sales of E15. As you said, I've had bills on this. In fact, I have a bill now that has been put into a bill that Senator Klobuchar has, and hopefully we're gonna get these two things moved together. And again, it's a bipartisan approach, recognizing the importance of agriculture to the United States by having this broad swath of senators supporting these issues, I think is extremely important.
Well, we'll keep an eye on that and many other things that we've discussed here today. Senator, we appreciate the time.
Thank you.
We'll be right back to hear from our panel. But first, our Hannah Pagel takes a look at the impact of trade disputes in this week's Map It Out.
In 2018, former President Donald Trump imposed tariffs on steel and aluminum imports from many of the United States' major trading partners. As a result, Canada, China, India, Mexico, Turkey, and the European Union all imposed retaliatory tariffs on U.S. exports, including a wide range of agricultural products. Across all commodities and states, USDA's Economic Research Service says annual U.S. losses from retaliatory tariffs from mid-2018 through 2019 were estimated to be about $13.2 billion, with much of the concentration impacting the Midwestern states, which you can see here in blue. Iowa and Illinois suffered the most among U.S. states, with each state losing approximately $1.4 billion annually. Producers of soybeans, sorghum, and pork were the commodities impacted the most, with U.S. soybeans accounting for the largest portion of total agricultural trade loss, topping out at nearly 71%. Sorghum accounted for 6%, and pork almost 5%. The Trump administration sought to soften the blow of retaliatory tariffs, especially the duties from China, through their use of the Market Facilitation Program, which compensated producers for trade losses in 2018 and 2019. Altogether, the program distributed about $23 billion over the course of those 2 years. For this week's Map It Out, I'm Hannah Pegel.
Farmers are always there for each other. We shed tears together. We celebrate together. But we also grow together. Farm Bureau is the largest general farm organization in the country. We have the farmers' back. If you're a farmer and you're not a member, we would welcome you into our Farm Bureau family. And if you want to know more about agriculture, come be part of this great family.
Welcome back to AgriPulse Newsmakers. Glad to be joined this week by a panel of beef industry experts here to discuss the recent legislative reintroduction of that Fisher-Grassley, Tester and Wyden bill, as well as some other beef industry issues. Really excited for this conversation. I'm going to bring in now Lee Richmond, the regional director with the U.S. Cattlemen's Association, and Ethan Lane, who is the chief lobbyist here in Washington for the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. Appreciate both of you taking the time to join us. And Lee, I'm going to go to you first here, because we saw Senators Fisher-Grassley and others reintroduce that legislation with some tweaks to reform their cattle price discovery framework. We've also seen the U.S. Cattlemen's Association come out with a statement in support of that new legislation. Given the changes, given the updates, why does USCA remain supportive of the bill?
We continue to believe that we need to see a minimum percent of negotiated cash trade to do basically what the bill is saying and to have a transparent market. We also believe in the contract library of having transparency to see what the marketplace truly is. And so no games are being played, and it's a free competitive market. So that's what, you know, two of the main reasons that we are seeing this. We've heard a lot from a lot of people in the countryside that want to push in for this kind of action. So that's why USCA continues to support it and will continue to support it going further.
And Lee, I'll bug Ethan about this here in a little bit, but I want to get your perspective first. There's been some farm groups that kind of have expressed a little bit of heartburn about that cash trade mandate. Why does USCA feel that that's the right way to go?
By our data, we've seen that, in particular, if you look at just December this last year of 2021, you look at where the marketplace was, where cash trade was higher, and when you have an increase in cash trade, you continue to have a strong competitive market. So that's why we continue to feel that we push for the cash minimum.
So Ethan, I want to bring you into the conversation here, because as Lee mentioned, a number of things in this bill, the cattle contract library, NCBA has policy and support. There's a number of other things that NCBA supports in this bill, but as I understand it, and unless you have news to break here for me, you all still remain in opposition to the bill due to the cash trade mandate?
We do. You know, I think we've spent more time on this issue inside NCBA and our suite of state affiliates nationwide over the last 2 years than any issue in recent memory. And there really has been a pretty sober conversation about just how this cash mandate would impact the operations of cattle producers from coast to coast. And we understand that those regional differences generate really different opinions on that. But the reality that we've come down to is that, while this is intended to force the packer's hand on how they engage with cattle producers, the real brunt of that impact is going to be felt by our producers and how they operate their businesses and their ability to choose the right marketing method for their cattle. You know, when we start to analyze the impact of expanding this mandate out in this most recent version to the entire country and creating this new nationwide regional system that would fit over the top of the five area, you start to see some numbers that are pretty concerning about the percentage of producers that would have to change their business model. You know, I mean, it's almost none in Iowa. I think 1% is the number I saw that would need to change their business model. But even in Nebraska, we're talking about perhaps 40% of producers that would have to revisit their business model to conform to these new mandates. That's really concerning for our producers. Everyone agrees we need a robust cash market. We need that price discovery. The reason cash trade is elevated is because of the work NCBA has done with its affiliates and feeders around the country to get those numbers up. That's a critical part of this, as is the transparency piece. And there's a lot of good stuff in this bill. The cattle contract library is definitely one of them. I was disappointed to see this most recent version step away from working on confidentiality. We think that's a big part of this puzzle as well. But that mandate is just something that's pretty unpopular with the vast majority of producers in the country. And we've seen that play out both at NCBA's convention and American Farm Bureau Federation's convention.
So, Ethan, you mentioned the work that NCBA has been doing on price discovery, but by NCBA's own metrics, that framework last year did not live up to the snuff that NCBA was hoping it would to elevate price discovery to the level that it was hoping. There are a sufficient number of triggers tripped. So, if a cash trade mandate isn't the way to bring price discovery, you know, into an increased framework, what is?
Well, so to be clear, I think the producer side of that equation absolutely did their job. They stepped up, they marketed more negotiated cattle, and they got those cash trade numbers up. The packers, we have found, and this shouldn't be a surprise to anybody, continued to implement their business models. And what we saw with that is, you know, exactly what we've seen in the market is packers that weren't buying in certain regions still aren't buying in certain regions. And that leads to a continuation of some of the confidentiality reporting problems. I mean, Colorado is a 60% non-report. It's a lot of transactions that aren't contributing to price discovery. We also have a lot of those trades around the country. Sale barn fats up in the north don't get reported as part of that bucket. There's a lot of missed data that's out there, but we also know that, you know, looking for some opportunities to increase cash trade has to mean making that an option that truly generates profit for producers the same way as these AMAs that they like to use. You know, one thing we keep hearing is everyone thinks that there needs to be more cash trade, but everyone also thinks their neighbor ought to be the one to do it. So we've got to look for some opportunities to make cash trade a viable option that's not requiring producers to give up either leverage or profit on their cattle to engage in that part of the marketplace. So that's going to really require, I think, a lot more work from the producer segment to figure out what those options look like. You know, the Fed Cattle Exchange, or I guess now Central Stockyard, some of those online tools, things that people are trying to figure out to make that work. The packers haven't engaged there in a real way. I know those guys are still trying to make that work, but we've got to look for those options to make cash trade a truly competitive option in the regions of the country where it's not. It works in Iowa, it works in Nebraska and places like that, and guys like using it, and that's great. But if we're gonna talk about making producers do something different in other parts of the country, we better have an option for them that's viable rather than just the force of regulation to make that happen.
We'll be right back with more from our panel right after this.
Looking closer, seeing further. That's how we do it. At Curious Plot, we're driven to find what's next for agriculture, animal care, and food. We stay curious because that's what it takes to grow understanding. That's how we plot strategies and tell stories that get results time after time. Marketing, communications, and consulting that look closer and see further. Curious Plot. We can't wait to help you tell your story.
Welcome back. We've asked about the legislation, but what is the current state of rural America and cattle production? We asked our panel to find out.
If you look at our input costs of every commodity that goes into what we use to produce an animal, and we continue to see a fat cattle market and that really hasn't gone up. That's not sustainable for producers in the long run, and this has continued to plague us for the last several years now. So, you know, we're seeing a very high slaughter cow and bull market that continues to be at elevated levels. Large part of that is due to drought, but we're also seeing that in other areas of part of the country, such as Missouri. And other states in the southeast where a lot of that pasture is going to get torn up and be planted to row crops just because they've been so much more profitable for the industry. I do think we will see quite a bit tighter numbers down the road. I think the drought has forced a lot of cattle into the feed yards. So we're getting these cattle feed reports that show that we have, you know, record numbers on feed. But I think we have very few cattle outside that feed yard. And down the road, we're going to see that. And particularly 2-3 years down the road, when all these cows that aren't there to have a calf again are now, you know, missing.
Mm-hmm. When we saw the COVID-19 pandemic happen, one of the things that took place was really a backing up throughout the various protein sectors. We saw this in chicken, we saw this in pork, we saw it in beef, you know, kind of a backing up of animals that were ready to be processed. In your mind as a producer and as a cattle feeder, has that recovery taken place quite yet?
Well, not necessarily, because again, we're still at a marketplace, and it is, we're higher than we were a year ago, but our input costs are now killing us. And we still have, we have record, the winter's been good. So we have, we're having record weights on these cows, or close to it. So we still have cattle that some would say would maybe backed up a little bit yet. I think we did get kind of back to somewhat of currentness, but we're still not near as current where we need to be for the producers to get their leverage back completely. Mm-hmm.
Ethan, I want to go to you because we heard Lee talk about some input price concerns, really producer profitability concerns.
Yeah.
From a legislative, from a regulatory, from a Washington, D.C. standpoint, what levers are there to be pulled to help producers on the profitability standpoint?
So I think a lot of what's been spurred over the last 2 years focusing on processing capacity offers a lot of opportunity in that space. You know, $1 billion coming out of USDA is no small matter, although it is still kind of shooting a BB gun at a tank when you look at the cost of implementing new processing capacity. But just adding new hooks is not going to solve our problem, and we know that. It's the kind of hooks that we add, right? Adding that regional diversified processing capacity, adding more options for marketing cattle for producers that don't fit that mold that works for some in the middle of the country. You know, if you're selling black-hided cattle on a grid to a big packer in Kansas, that model works great for you. But how do we make sure that the producer in Georgia or Pennsylvania or someone like that has a robust market to sell into as well, with options that work for them? You know, that kind of plays into some of the conversations on labeling, getting rid of product of the USA in its current form, and looking for some more opportunities for producers to work into some marketing programs that can support those small regional packing facilities, keep them full of cattle, and also deliver more of the beef dollar back to producers is something that's really attractive to us, and we think gives the producers more of a driver's seat in figuring out where they go and where their operations go. So we're excited to keep working with USDA on that. We know a lot of producers are engaging in that process as those RFPs roll out, looking for opportunities to set up some new plant capacity. And we want to make sure we continue to foster that. But we've got to make sure that those plants stay viable. You know, when we go into the rest of this cattle cycle, we know what's going to happen, right? It's fairly predictable. That producer profitability is going to grow because that herd size is shrinking. And we're going to see the packers go from those huge margins we've seen down to reduced margins or even losses at some point. And when that happens, we got to make sure that this new expanded capacity isn't the victim of that market swing. We don't want to lose some of those good diversified options that are going to get added over the next couple of years. So we've really got to be thinking about business model. We've got to be thinking about how to make sure they stay viable through this market cycle. Mm-hmm.
Always plenty to keep an eye on in the beef cattle industry. Gentlemen, we appreciate the time and for you stopping by to join us and discuss that.
Great to be with you.
You bet. Thanks.
We'll be right back with more AgriPulse Newsmakers. But first, our Hannah Pagel takes a look at the role of small farms in modern agriculture in this week's Ag by the Numbers.
According to a new report released by USDA's Economic Research Service, small family farms own less than half of the total U.S. farmland, but produce only a fifth of the agricultural production by value. Small family farms are defined by USDA as those with gross cash farm income under $350,000 a year, whereas large-scale family farms are defined with an income over $1 million. In 2020, small family farms operated 48% of U.S. farmland, down from 52% in 2011, and accounted for 20% of production by value. Large-scale family farms saw an increase in total value of production to 46% in 2020, but these farms also work 24% of the land, a big jump from 16% in 2011. When looking at profit, ERS says 42% of small farms lost money in 2020, compared to 18% of larger farms. However, ERS notes that many small farmers do not consider farming their primary occupation and receive much of their income from off-farm sources, which is not reflected in the operating profit margin. For AgriPulse, I'm Hannah Pagel.
Did you know AgriPulse has all your favorite podcasts, including Open Mic, Newsmakers, and Drive Time? Take us wherever you go. Subscribe at AgriPulse.com or on Spotify, Google Play, or Apple Podcasts.
Agriculture Future of America is a nonprofit building transformational leaders in food and agriculture. AFA prepares college students to join the workforce as innovative and engaged young professionals who will shape the future of agriculture. Head to agfuture.org to find out how you can get involved.
Thanks again for tuning in for another episode of AgriPulse Newsmakers. Before we let you go, here's what's on the horizon for the week to come. The House Ag Committee has a pair of Farm Bill hearings scheduled. There's a Tuesday full committee hearing on renewable energy opportunities, and on Wednesday, the Livestock and Foreign Agriculture Subcommittee will look at international trade and food assistance programs. USDA will roll out its first crop progress report on Monday to detail how planting is coming along and later the condition of the country's crops. And I'll be on the road representing the National Association of Farm Broadcasting at the National Agri-Marketing Conference in Kansas City. But I'll leave you in the capable hands of my colleague, Jeff Nally. As always, stay tuned to AgriPulse.com for the latest developments in food and ag policy. For AgriPulse Newsmakers, I'm Spencer Chase. Have a good one.
Newsmakers is a production of AgriPulse Communications. For more ag policy news, visit AgriPulse.com. You can also find our new content on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to follow AgriPulse and our correspondents on social media to get breaking news and more.